Interested, you can go and see a particle physics detector in the next building. There's the Bavar some vertex tracker, but you can go and see. Probably a good time to see it either in the lunch break or in the coffee break, and probably maybe we'll get some Bavar person to accompany us over and explain the intricacies of what you're seeing. But it's just interesting to see a particle physics detector.
Try to get out.
All right. Good morning, everyone. We are starting the session with Adam Morgan speaking about gamma ray bursts from what I remember.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. My name is Adam Morgan. I'm a graduate student at UC Berkeley working on astronomy. And today I'll be talking about some work I've done on the problem of how to make decisions on new events and using rapid machine learned resource allocation, and in particular the application of it to my particular field of interest of gamma ray burst follow-up. So just a quick shout-out, part of a group called the Center for Time Domain Informatics at Berkeley, consisting of members from astronomy, statistics, and computer science, and a great collaboration over the last few years. It's been a wonderful opportunity for me to get involved with all this statistics stuff that I hear is so important. Quick introduction sort of leads off nicely from what George was talking about at the end of the day yesterday. In the old days, discovery in astronomy was very rare. We only found a few objects, and for each one, we could afford to throw all of our resources at it and just have a bunch of follow-up to really understand what was going on with every new object. For example, you know, if we had a big survey and found a bunch of supernova candidates, we could afford to have a team of undergraduates go and look at each one to see whether each one was worthy of follow-up, and then throw some big glass spectroscopy at it. That's no longer the case. We are coming into this. Oh, jeez. Sorry about that. We're coming into the age of way too many discoveries. We're getting the state of deluge. As was mentioned yesterday, the amount of data in astronomy is doubling every year and a half. So we have these huge discovery engines like Palomar Transient Factory, PanSTARRS, the Catalina Sky Survey that are unveiling more events than we can afford to follow up. So we need to be able to make decisions as each new event happens, potentially time-sensitive decisions of whether or not we want to follow up. So for every new event that goes off, we need to make a decision in real time of what we're going to do with it. Because we can't have thousands of undergrads looking through every single new event. So we have this overarching goal that sort of sets us up for this project. Given this limited follow-up telescope time, we want to be able to maximize the time spent on interesting sources. And there's a few limitations to this. We are often looking for rare events. So what this means is that we're not simply trying to get the most number of classifications correct, but rather we're trying to optimize the allocation of our resources. So that's an important point. If we were just trying to get the most number of classifications correct, we would, you know, just ignore all the rare sources because they wouldn't affect our completeness very much. We also must be flexible. Different astronomers might have different priorities of what they want to follow up. Some might have more telescope resources so they can afford to follow up more false sources in the effort to get the one really, really rare source. And also, some might have different priorities of what kinds of sources they want to follow up. And it also must be rapid. Transient events often require quick decisions before they fade beyond detectability. So we have to let the robots take over somewhat. So a quick introduction to the area of study of which I was applying this, gamma ray bursts. For those that aren't aware, gamma ray bursts are these huge flashes of gamma rays with extremely energetic explosions and cosmologically. So that means in very, very distant galaxies. And there's this initial burst of gamma rays that allows us to detect these events. There's a satellite, several satellites in space, one of which I'll talk about in more detail in a minute, that detect this initial burst of gamma rays. So they're very easy to detect. They're very easy to, know we have a new event that went off. But we don't know when and where they're going to occur in space. So we always have to be on our toes to be able to follow it up at any time. And this initial burst is followed by a longer-lived afterglow at longer wavelengths, X-ray, ultraviolet, optical, etc., which we can use ground-based follow-up telescopes to get more and more information about these events. So the important point, one of the important points here is that because they occur at such extreme luminosities, we can use them to probe very, very far back into the early universe. So we can just detect them at very large distances and lift the feedback further than we would be able to with traditional astronomical sources and probes. The image I stole from George, apparently. We're looking for, in this era, back even before less than a billion years after the Big Bang, to study the so-called reionization era, the sort of dark ages of the universe before we could really see what was going on. From stars and galaxies on their own. So this quick identification and detailed study of the gamma ray bursts offers a unique probe into the early universe, but only if we can detect and identify that they might be of interest in a high redshift early enough in order to follow them up before they fade to obscurity. So we chose this follow-up criterion of high redshift, and we want to prioritize the follow-up of the highest redshift events, which corresponds to this back in space and time, the highest. So you can imagine, prioritizing something else, some other kind of feature of a gamma ray burst or any other kind of transient. You can pick your prioritization. You can pick the type of sources that you want to follow up. For the purposes of this project, we just said we want to follow up high redshift sources. So we treat this as a classification problem. We needed to make, in order to break it up into a binary classification problem, we needed to create a cutoff. So we said anything with a redshift of higher than 4 warrants follow-up, and anything less than I registered before was uninteresting, and we didn't care about it. So the discovery engine in question here is the Swift Gamma-ray Burst mission. It has three different telescopes on board. The First Alert telescope is the big gamma-ray detector that I talked about earlier. This is what allows us to see that a gamma-ray burst went off. Then it also has these follow-up telescopes, which give us refined positions on the sky and more information as time goes on. So this all happens very rapidly. Gamma-ray bursts only last the order of a few seconds to tens of seconds in terms of the gamma-ray emission. And then they have this longer-lived afterglow and the X-ray and optical regimes, which last on the order of hours to days. So, yeah, the typical observing scenario is we get the high-energy gamma-ray emission, get a rough position from that, which leads us to more and more refined positions and more details as time goes on. So as time goes on, this picture emerges of whether it's worth investing additional resources, such as very extensive large aperture telescopes for spectroscopy. But we need to make this decision before it fades to obscurity. By the time we realize it's interesting, it might be too late. So this overarching goal here is we want to use this rapidly available information to make inferences about whether a new event might be interesting, or you can define interesting however you want. You just need to build your classifier based on that criteria. So we want to reduce this question of should I observe or not down to a single parameter, which we call Q-hat. And each astronomer can have his own criterion of how many he or she wants to observe. And if the fraction of events that you want to observe is larger than Q hat, then you say, yes, I want to observe that event. If the fraction of events that one can observe is less than Q hat, then you say, no, I'm going to ignore that event. So our training data to test out this methodology was gamma ray bursts detected by the Swift satellite. We had a training set of 135 gamma ray bursts that had measured redshifts. There are about 600 gamma ray bursts overall, but only at the time of this this work, only around 150 of them had measured redshifts. 18 of them had the cutoff criterion of redshift greater than 4. So here's the distribution, and these are the ones we're looking for, these ones in 5. We had to pick features based on the early time high-energy information. High-energy, we also used a little bit of optical based on one optical telescope on board. All of these features came from onboard the Swift satellite, and all of them are rapidly available. So here is plotted a selection of 4 of those features against each other. You start to see some patterns emerging here. We have in gray here all the ones that don't have measured redshifts. And we're trying to distinguish between the black and the red, the ones that are low redshift and high redshift. So using all these features and put them into a big classifier to try to distinguish between all these things. The classification methodology that we're using is using the random forest classification, which has several benefits for our data set. Some of which include the ability to handle categorical features, of which we have a couple, which are basically yes-no parameters. For instance, was it detected in the optical wavelengths? Was it like trigger A or trigger B that caused it to go off? And it also produces this probabilistic output that for each new event that is important for this methodology. So this is a bit of a heavy slide. This kind of describes the entire process of what we call the Random Forest Automated Triage Estimator for VRB redshift. My little acronym makes rate VRBZ. So going through, as each new gamma ray burst is discovered, so first we build a classifier using the 135 training events that we have. Each one of them gives us an out-of-bag probability from the training set that we put on a table here, and then we rank all these probabilities. And then for each new GRB that is discovered, each new burst event that happens, we feed it into the classifier that we built. This gives us a new probability, And we compare this probability to the probabilities from the out-of-bag and the training events, see that it falls between rank 30 and 31, and then based on this, we give it a value Q hat, which, again, is our follow-up criterion parameter. So say we have two different astronomers. Astronomer A can follow up on 25% of sources, since our Q hat value is 0.23, this astronomer is thus assigned to observe this event because Q hat is less than the fraction of events that this astronomer wants to observe. Astronomer B only wants to follow up 20% of events. They decide, no, this isn't high enough priority for me. I'm not going to observe it. So in terms of seeing how well we can do in measuring performance, we guard against overfitting using cross-validation to just avoid overfitting the data. We take a bunch of trials of tenfold cross-validation where we break up the data in 10 parts, use 90% of the data to predict on 10%, and do this many times, average over many trials to make robust performance statistics. Here's some cross-validated performance of our data set. We have here the efficiency, so this is plotting fraction of GRBs that are followed up over versus the fraction of GRBs actually observed. So this line shows random guessing. If we just followed up without any knowledge whatsoever, we should expect that we get this straight line. So you can see if we follow up 20% of the gamma ray bursts, we can capture 55% of all high-risk events. Right? We can also measure performance based on purity, the percent of GRBs that we observe that are actually high Z. So this is much lower because we have rather low purity because we're trying to prioritize these high these rare events. Random guessing is just this line, which is just a fraction of high-redshift GRBs compared to all GRBs in our data set. And if we can take a point on this line and say if we follow up 20%, 35% of GRBs will be high-redshift. And you can dial up and down your follow-up strategy based on your desired efficiency purity. Once you have these curves for your particular your interest, you can say, okay, if I devote 20%, I can get this efficiency and this purity. If I devote, if I follow up 60% of all events, then I can get, you know, almost 95% of all high redshift events, but I'll have a purity of only 20%. You can also check calibration to make sure that our users, our follow-up fraction actually corresponds to the actual number of events that we recommend for follow-up. This is sort of a subtle point, but we just want to make sure that we're getting what we say we're getting. We applied the classifier to all events that don't have a known redshift, so these are unclassified events. And we see that we do roughly correct. We say, you know, if you want to follow up 40%, we will say you're going to follow up 40%. Talking about some of the challenges we had, as I mentioned at the beginning, we had we care really about the rare events, and these are a relatively small fraction of all training events. And we don't just want to get the most classifications correct, so we tested a bunch of different weighting factors in the force classification and punished misclassifications of interesting events more strongly. Here is showing some of these different efficiency curves for different weights. Similarly, one thing I didn't really appreciate at the beginning of this project was that how important feature selection is. At the beginning, I thought, you know, more data is better. Let's just throw everything we have at it, hopefully we'll get the classifier possible. But we can't just throw the kitchen sink at the problem. Because we have such a small training data set of only 135 events, the number of features that are completely useless actually does matter. So here was an experiment we did where we just assigned completely useless features. We added them to our base training set to see how they would affect performance. And you can see even with a couple useless features, you see performance starts to degrade. So we start to overwhelm the data set with useless information. We can also try to measure feature importance of these features. Well, the way we approached this was we took our base training set and we initially had 12 features, and we removed one by one each of the features and then retrain the classifier and saw how that would change the performance to see if it would improve or degrade the performance. You can see there's a couple features here that significantly will degrade the performance if they're removed. Shown in gray here is the one sigma variation overall speeds that we tested. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's if there's no degradation, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a useless feature and that there's no information in there, just that it might be redundant with another feature. Test the validation set. As time goes on, we can retrain the classifier to improve performance further. And we also want dissemination to community, so I built up this website where, as a new event happens, we'll publish a new register. A new value of the importance parameter Q hat. So if you'd like to find out more information, there's a paper available on this subject. Address here, you can always contact me if you have any questions or if you think you might want to apply this kind of method to one of your own problems. I'd love to hear about it. So that's it. Thank you very much. I'd like to open the questions.
I didn't quite understand all the physical significance of the input variables, but can you say to what extent are the input variables that you use correlated with those properties of the gamma ray burst that you eventually want to study after you've selected them? Do you not then run the risk of pre-selecting a sample that conforms to a certain notion of how what a gamma ray burst looks like and then simply confirming that?
Right. So there's not what we're training on are a lot of these high energy properties, which there might be some minor correlation with the parameter of interest, redshift, of the distance from the from us that the gamma ray burst lies. But it's a very complex relationship, and it's not, there's not a strict physical model that will say, you know, if I combine all of these features that I'm training on, can I calculate the redshift? There's been attempts to try to do that, but it's a very difficult problem. And really, the approach we made here was, you know, just trying to make these priorities and say, you know, will I follow up? I mean, should I follow up this event? And in the hope that it will actually be a higher risk event.
You showed a classification tree, and I think three out of the four nodes corresponded to a continuous variable that you converted to a yes-no by thresholding. Is it a useful exercise at the end of that process to go back to the continuous data space, so to speak, and look at how good the clusters are? Are they narrowly defined, non-overlapping things, or are they fuzzy blobs that do overlap and so on?
Well, from what I understand, I showed one classification tree, but what we're using, that was just an example, that would be a single part tree. But what we're using is random forest, which is this, you know, thousands of those trees averaged together. And it's very hard to make any inferences about the actual physical relationships based on that. So my answer to that is that I don't think it's very easy, if not impossible, to try to make physical inferences based on the random forest classifier that comes out of this. This is really trying to make a black box for prediction rather than something physical of which we can understand how these variables interact with each other to try to make the right answer.
I was wondering, you know, what code you use to do the classification tree?
We're using the random forest code within R.
I have one question. I'm worried a little bit about what happens next. Meaning you have the set of all these gamma ray bursts that you followed up. So now you have a sample of stuff that's been followed up. Typically, when we used to do this before, we used to have flux limited samples and we used to understand what kind of biases that introduced into the samples in future analysis. Have you figured out what kind of biases we should worry about when you're dealing with something like this Q-hat?
Working on reverse in particular?
Q-hat and this kind of in general.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I've fully understood the question, but as we are continuing to track all the new events that occur and see how they perform compared to the expected pure security and efficiency that our performance metrics predicted. As time goes on, we can always retrain the classifier, adding this new information to try to make a better classifier. I mean, it wasn't complete. We only had 135 events. As time goes on, we can always improve this. But we believe that the metrics that we provided with an error should be robust.
Right. Not about the Q-hat itself, but suppose you wanted to take these gamma errors and construct a luminosity function afterwards. How would you know that there should be modifications that need to be made at different luminosities or redshifts or
so using these the Q-hat values as scientific parameters itself. Yeah, I would guard against doing something like that. As I said before, this is not trying to we're not trying to do scientific inference here. We're only trying to make predictions of whether or not to follow. Because of all the ways that we broke this up into a classification problem of redshift greater than 4 or less than 4. There's just so many uncertainties within that I think trying to make scientific inferences on the Q-hat values themselves is at best a very hard problem. We did apply the classifier to all of the gamma reverse with unknown redshifts to see how their distributions light up. We see, I showed that the calibration curve, and there was a little bit of a deviation from a straight line that we would have expected. It's not clear to me how exactly to make science like inferences about the populations of GRBs based on that parameter.
Any further questions?
So I just wanted to ask whether you had what in particle physics we call a look elsewhere effect. I mean, all the gamma ray bursts that you initially sort of discover really are gamma ray bursts, are they? Because, I mean, you've got many, many chances of getting random fluctuations at any part of the sky and any part of the time or spatial period. So I don't know what factor that comes out as, but...
essentially zero. I mean, if we know, if a gamma ray burst goes off, it's blazingly bright. We know it's a gamma ray burst. So that we don't have to worry about that.
Okay, good.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Exactly on time. The next speaker is Peter Tannenbaum.
It's been so long since I gave a talk, the technology has actually evolved. So good morning. So I'll talk to you about detection of transiting planet candidates and the Kepler mission data. I can actually get through this relatively quickly because the planet Venus explained all of this to all of you yesterday. But Kepler is a space-based photometer searching for Earth-sized exoplanets that does that using transit photometry. And so you have to monitor a large number of stars. We monitor about 150,000 stars. We do this almost continuously for 3 or more years, looking for periodic dips in intensity. The total data set actually includes 190,000 stars, but it's about 150-something that we consider that we're looking at just for planet detection. The spacecraft uses a huge field of view, 115 square degrees. You can see the field of view here, Cygnus and Lyra. So this is visible in the night sky in the summer. The spacecraft itself is in an Earth-trailing heliocentric orbit, so for the spacecraft, the field of view is available continually. There's 96 megapixels on the focal plane and 42 CCDs. Each CCD has two readout channels, so there's a total of 84. It was launched in March of 2009. Here's some sample transit light curves for you, but you all know about this from yesterday. So we'll move on. So Kepler data and processing. Kepler records the intensity of selected pixels on a 29.4-minute cadence, and the pixels are selected on the ground and commanded to the spacecraft. What that means is there's no way you can get 96 megapixels down at 30-minute intervals with the kind of bandwidth you can get to space. There's not enough Ethernet cable in the entire world to do that, and so we have to select which pixels are the ones that capture the light we care about, tell the spacecraft to collect only those. That information is sent down once a month. Once every three Kepler months, 93 days, we have to rotate the spacecraft about its axis to keep the solar panels pointed at the sun and the thermal radiator pointed into space. Any other orientation does not work. So that means that a given star is imaged on four different CCDs over the course of a Kepler year, and the CCDs are all slightly different. They all have slightly different optics. And so we go through this processing where first the raw pixels are calibrated, then they're combined from pixels into a single light curve. The systematics are removed in pre-search data conditioning. Those light curves, which are one per quarter per target, goes to TPS. TPS combines the light curves from individual quarters and performs its search. A number of events which are thought to have transits in them, transit threshold crossing events, or TCEs, are forwarded to the data validation module, which does a model fit and then a suite of validation tests that are too complicated to even describe. And that goes to, those are persisted to the data store, and then the actual astrophysicists take a look at what comes out of there. So to set the scale, the transit of an exo-Earth orbiting an exo-Sun is about a 13-hour event. It occurs once per 365 days with 100 parts per million maximum depth. And a transit event, transit candidate is defined by three events. That's necessary to ensure that it has periodicity. So the scale of the problem is that we're searching 190,000 stars. They're sampled every 30 minutes for several years. We're looking for a periodic dip in intensity can be as small as 100 parts per million, and that's against the background of stellar variability. To give you a sense of what that means to us, here's a light curve where the scale is about 5,000 parts per million. There's a 300 part per million transit signal in this light curve. You're not going to find that with the naked eye in any reasonable way. Though actually, if you do see this with the naked eye, please come see me after the talk. We'd like to put you to work. So the key issues are, we call these the three commandments of TPS. First is thou shalt reject the false detections, because false detections lead to excessive computational load and data validation, and then excessive vetting effort on the part of the human beings, and we only have so many human beings. Thou shalt retain the true detections. Now, the true detections are expected to be only a few percent of all targets, and the reason for that is that you only see transits if the solar system is inclined so that the plane of the orbit is in your line of sight. If the solar system is oriented like this, you see it. If it's oriented like that, you can't. So we don't want the false detection removal to accidentally take out any true detections. We expect the true detections to be a small fraction. And then thou shalt get the data through in a reasonable length of time, because 190,000 times anything is a big number. Back when we were doing commissioning of the CCDs, we said 42 times anything is a big number, but our sites have moved up. So first thing we have to do is deal with stellar variability. Stellar variability is much larger than the signals we're typically looking for, and it's highly non-white and non-stationary, and fortunately for us, it doesn't look in the time domain or in the frequency domain anything like the signals we care about. So here's a light curve with four transits in it, and you can see there's some variability. In this case, I used big transits, which you can see by eye, to convince you that this actually works. We need a joint time frequency approach to do the removal. The $10 word we use for that is a wavelet-based digital filter bank. But for those of you who have stereo equipment from the 80s, you recognize that this is just a fancy ESP version of a stereo with a graphic equalizer. The graphic equalizer has little levers that are in octave bands. And so essentially what you do is you send the signal in, and there's a robot which constantly adjusts the graphic equalizer bars so that what comes out is white noise. So this light curve is converted to this one, which is white noise plus impulsive outliers like transits. And see that it actually works. You can also see a couple of other interesting features that we'll discuss a little more. First is these transits are about equally deep. These clearly are not. The second is these transits are really transit-like. They go down and then back up. And here you see they don't look like that quite so much. They look like this. This is a real transit. This is what happens after you whiten it. The whitening process distorts the shape of the transit. The distortion varies in time because the noise content light curve varies, and that's why the depth of the distorted transits is different, even though the depth of the original transits is the same. So your problem now is that you're searching for a time-varying signal against a background of white noise. Now, that is easier than searching for a constant signal against a time-varying background, so you have actually won by doing this. The next step is to search for individual transits. And the way you do that is you correlate your whitened flux against the distorted square model transit pulse. We use a square model because it's simple. We use 14 different transit durations from 1.5 hours, which is 3 samples, to 15 hours, which is actually 31 samples. And this produces a signal time series and a noise time series, and the ratio of this is the so-called single event statistic time series, abbreviated SES. You see here, here's the signal time series in arbitrary units, the noise time series, and their ratio. So as the noise is varying by up to a factor of 2 here, you can see that that results in a variation in the single event statistic, even though the transits are nominally of equal depth. The different durations are used so that if you're... Your single event statistic, one of the things that goes into it is it's saying how much does this transit look like my model? And if they're wildly different in duration, the answer is going to be not much. And so we use a bunch of different durations to look for, you know, short transits, which are typically in short period orbits, longer transits, which are typically in longer period orbits, so that we have a prayer of capturing most, if not all, of them. So step 2 is to fold the statistics at your selected periods and phases to form the multiple event statistic. And here's where you start to have fun, because the folding time scales roughly as the square of the time series length. So you double your time series length. It takes 4 times as long to do the folding. So here you see the multiple event statistic as a function of period. Here's the period in days. Here's a peak. And as you expect, there's a comb of lower peaks at harmonics and subharmonics of the true frequency. You identify the period and phase combination which produces the maximum multiple event statistic, and you're done. Well, you're not quite done. Every target has some combination of period and phase, which is the max multiple event statistic for that target. Duh, that's the definition of maximum. Every function that's not a flat line has a maximum and a minimum. So you need to set a threshold, which cuts off multiple event statistic values, which are due to chance alignments of noise. And we did a pre-launch study, which said that 7.1 sigma threshold would limit statistical false positives to 1 per mission. That's pretty impressive when you think about it, and you think about the fact that, you know, people talk about 5 sigma detection, and we're saying 5 sigma detection is no good. We would have far too many false detections at 5 sigma. Now, let's go back to our exo-Earth, the alien Kepler and some other distant star system pointing at Earth. It would see 3 transits. It would need to see 3 transits of 4.1 sigma. So the expected variability for sun-like stars is 20 parts per million. Exo-Earth is 100 parts per million. So you can see that you get about 5 sigma. So with 3 transits, you would have no problem seeing this, or so we thought. So it turns out there were a couple of problems. One, which I won't get into here, is that actually the stellar variability is higher than we thought. We needed a model of stellar variability to build our code base against. We used the sun because it was the only example we really knew. Now we've got a lot more examples, and we've discovered that, as we say upstairs in the Science Operations Center, the sun is not a sun-like star. The sun is quieter than typical FGK main sequence stars by about a factor of 50%. So it turns out that we're going to need more data because we need to beat that down with root N. But we also have other problems. The first is, here's a sample plot where we ran 190,000 targets with 10 quarters of data, and we got about 86,000 targets with a multiple event statistic greater than 7 sigma, when we were expecting to have maybe one. Clearly, this has to be dominated by false alarms. There's not 86,000 stars out of 190,000 which have the proper inclination angle for us to see them. So what happens? The first thing is that the spacecraft environment is very different from our original understanding, and that results in the strong features here in this wedge plot. Most notably, the spacecraft has to reorient itself once every month to point its high-gain antenna at the Earth to send its data down, and then it turns back to the science field of view. There's a thermal transient when you do that, and that was not appreciated at the time of launch, and we've spent a lot of effort since then chasing phenomena like that. That's an example, but there's actually a tremendous number of little things in the spacecraft that can produce a change which can result in a few sigma effects. Now, the other problem, of course, is that you also have this haze, this dust cloud of events that aren't related to strong features. That's because the detection statistics of individual targets have long non-Gaussian tails for reasons that we are only just starting to get into and understand. TPS folding doesn't check to make sure that the statistics which go into a multiple event statistic are sensible. So what that means is you're not just seeing here places where you had 3 events of 4 sigma. You're also seeing places where you had 1 event of 20 sigma. You folded that on top of some things that were 1 or 2 sigma. When you combine them, it was still over 7 sigma. So your long Gaussian tail is a serious problem. Anybody who worked on the Stanford Linear Collider can tell you that. And so what we need here, Tom would tell you, we need collimation. Now we need to start collimating our tail. So we added a couple of features to reduce the false alarms. First was a thing called the robust statistic. The robust statistic says, well, let's actually fit a model transit, the period and phase of the multiple event statistic. That should help to identify cases with highly unequal events. And by using robust weighting, we can maybe even identify which samples were bad and suppress them. Now, this reduces the number of detections to about 25,000. You can see that there's fewer features in this plot, though others remain. The reason that the robust statistic doesn't do the whole job is it turns out that it has similar weaknesses to multiple event statistics. It can actually be spoofed by a mixture of one strong and several weak events. It has some ability to detect those, but its abilities are limited. The next step was to use the relationships among these different statistics. Take advantage of the fact that most false alarms have one strong event. So originally we looked at the ratio between the multiple and the single event statistics. And ideally that the ratio should be root N, where N is the number of events. And in the case of a strong outlier, it's going to be more like 1. Thank you. So this was effective. We later moved to this statistic, which is more effective but has a less strong theoretical basis. It's more empirical, so we don't like it as much. But combining all of these capabilities, we get down to about 11,800 detections. That's, or threshold crossing events. That's acceptable for now. It's not perfect, but it's acceptable. Now let's talk about execution time. TPS is almost all MATLAB M files. The exception is the folding, which is done in the C language MEX file. Multi-thread capability. Our runtime is dominated by the folding. Somewhat non-deterministic because the robust statistic algorithm can remove some samples and ask for refolding. The times are acceptable for now. Here's a distribution of our fitting times in hours. The long tail is down here in the separate one. It runs on the NASA supercomputer at Ames, where so we can run everything in a day. Helps to have a neighbor who owns a supercomputer. But N squared scaling is brutal. An 8-year mission, typical targets will take 2.5 hours, and some targets will take 70 hours, and data validation, which also uses TPS, will also take way too long, which it already does anyway, so it'll take way, way too long. So for future developments, current search logic is clearly inadequate. If a statistic ratio test indicates a false detection, the search exits. So right now, the answer to this question, what if there's a real signal, which is weak, buried beneath a strong one, which is spurious in a star? Right now, the answer is you're out of luck. What we want the answer to be is that we go back and look at the data in a way that digs out the weaker signals until all possible detections are exhausted. If we do this, it is statistically likely that we'll accept more false alarms, but hope to get more true detections. And we need to take care about maintaining an adequate execution speed, since in principle we can wind up looping over a lot of false positives to find the true ones. Second of all, the statistic ratio has always been somewhat ad hoc. We're testing a better method for throwing out the false alarms, and it directly examines the shape and depth of the transits and the time frequency decomposition, looking for the ones that are consistent with the true transit trial transit pulse with an expected variation. It's much better and more theoretically sound. In early tests, execution speed is acceptable. And throughput will continue to be a challenge as the data volume increases. We do not expect the NASA supercomputer's capabilities to keep up. We also find that shipping huge volumes of data to the supercomputer and back is a problem. It's a supercomputer, not a super network. We have a few things we can do to cheaply beat the CPU time down, but we expect that as we get on towards 7 or 8 years of data, we're going to need a faster algorithm for folding. And that's what I've got. Oh. This is a team effort, and this is the team. Questions?
I was just wondering why not decompose the signal in wave. You mentioned wavelets, but also Dirac deltas.
But also what?
Delta functions. It looks like.
I don't have an answer for that. This is, at the moment, this is what we do. I guess the answer is that we first apply the wavelets to do the whitening, and then we correlate with a distorted delta function. The problem is that once you get down, in that example, it's clear that you could do it by just convolving the data with something that looks sort of like a delta function. In practice, once the noise becomes large compared to the signal, that won't work anymore, is what I think is the answer.
So I didn't see any work which was sort of trying to model the response of your instrument and really putting in details and understanding the PDF that you're saying you know out to 7 sigma. I think it's very unlikely. That's, you're assuming some Gaussian distribution, which you're finding, of course, is untrue. That would have been my guess at the very beginning of this thing, because every real experiment is not Gaussian, it's 7 sigma. So how do you plan to really model the instrument? You're learning an awful lot about how it works and such, so you could have some Monte Carlo situations where you then try to make sure that you really understand your criteria, and also you can check your Monte Carlo against your empirical distributions that are not.
There is some effort going on in that direction. There is some effort, some Monte Carlo effort going on that that members of the science office are working on. A lot of the understanding of the instrument is in these areas. So, for example, the understanding of the CCDs is mainly here. The understanding of the optics is partially here, partially here. The understanding of the instrumental effects that are more or less across the focal plane is mainly here. I could talk to this figure for several days. But there's actually another part of your question that I'd like to address, which is what particle physicists usually do, in my experience from being here, is that they build a simulated data set which is comparable in scale to their real data set, and they test out their real analyses and detection algorithms against that data set. There was a limited pre-launch effort to do that, limited by the fact that our models for stellar variability in particular were extremely primitive. Our models of the spacecraft time domain transients were non-existent. But I think in general, there was not any effort to really do this the way that a particle physicist would, and I think that was sorely lacking. And I think that's a crucial stage for any future mission of this scale. Now, I have said this at least once a week for 5 years, is we have to approach the design and the funding phase of the experiment as though understanding and surviving your data stream is part of the mission. It's part of the mission cost. And if you don't want to pay that cost, you can't do the mission.
Just to follow up on this question, one of the main problems that I think you got trapped in is that the stellar variability is not Gaussian. It is very likely a Pareto or a power law distribution, and possibly sitting on top of a sinusoid. So you know, you would definitely see more larger variations that way, simply because there's a long tail that you have to deal with.
We definitely see that most of the things that we look at, the variability is defined more by pink noise or red noise. And
this is a question that also has applicability to Adam's talk, and that is, how about all the signals that you didn't detect because they were buried in the noise, and say the output of this analysis is a really nice sample of very clear exoplanets, but suppose we're interested in the rate, what's the fraction of stars out there that have exoplanets?
Right, that's exactly what we're interested in.
Because they were buried in the noise, and we have to go and calibrate the noise and maybe actually use the stars and ask ourselves which possible exoplanets could we have missed because they were not detectable.
Yes, there's a substantial effort involved in answering that question as well, the completeness question, which is I don't know if I should say it's above my pay grade or below my elevation, because I'm on the third floor and the people who work on that are on the first floor. But that's a huge issue. And you know, that's not the only hole in our detectability. If you took the baseline Kepler mission and you put it in an extraterrestrial solar system and pointed it at the Earth, and the inclination angle was right, how many transiting exoplanets would you see? You would see definitely see two if the mission was long enough. You might see three or four. You would miss the entirety of the outer planets because the mission's not long enough. You would only see one transit at most of any of the outer planets. So most of the mass of the solar system outside of the sun you would never see. And what can I tell you? You need more instruments and more data acquisition time, and you know, and eventually you run out of budget in the whole planet.
Any other questions? And if not, thank the speaker again. Speaker.
In the next couple of days so that we can put them up as soon as possible. Already
quite a lot of people have been saying they are interested in looking over the talks, which is a very good sign. So we want to get those up as soon as possible. The ones that we have on the computer here, we should be able to deal with. If we have any problems, we'll let you know. Please send them as soon as possible. People have to sign release forms also.
So, go and talk to Suzanne in front, and you can hand her your stick, and she can download it to her computer, and then you can sign the release form at the same time and get her to somebody over there.
And you want PDF or PDF?
It only has to be PDF?
Well, PDF is possible because if you have different kind of computers, they can't be read by everybody. PDF seems to be pretty universal.
Okay, so, Becca?
All right, thank you very much. I really enjoyed being here and appreciate the invitation to talk a little bit about the issues that Anton and Stefano raised during their photon science talks yesterday and the day before. We saw several different applications of photon science, ranging from tomography and cytography and nanocrystallography to coherent diffraction imaging, and several others as well. And throughout these different discussions, we've seen several kind of salient challenges that have arisen over and over again. One of the key challenges is that the signals or the scenes or the molecules that are attempting to reconstruct are intrinsically very high dimensional. There's a large number of degrees of freedom that we have available, and we're trying to infer those different parameters or those different degrees of freedom from a relatively small amount of data. So in many situations, the systems that we're trying to deal with are underdetermined, where we've got less observations or fewer observations than we have unknown. In addition, in many of these applications, we have a limited number of photons. So for instance, in some of these diffraction imaging applications where you're hitting your molecule with a laser, you can't make the laser power too large or you risk destroying the information it's trying to infer. In addition, many times the forward models that we're dealing with are very complex, and I think Stefano did a particularly good job of explaining some of those forward models the other day. So what I'd like to do today is to try to put a lot of these issues together in one framework and describe a little bit about what we can say about how well we can perform inference in the face of some of these challenges. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say that F star here is going to be the signal of interest. And I say signal in a very generic sense, if it corresponds to some kind of image that corresponds to the uptake of some radiopharmaceutical and medical imaging, could correspond to the structure of a protein or molecule, or some kind of scene in X-ray astronomy. In general, we're interested in a situation where we can't observe F-star directly, but rather F-star undergoes some kind of transformation before it gets anywhere close to our detector. So that transformation, which I'm going to denote A here, could correspond to tomographic projections, it could correspond to the X-ray diffraction process, it could correspond to a coded aperture imaging system, or what have you. So what we do is we observe this transformed version of the signal we're interested in, AF, through photons. We make Poisson observations of that construct, and our goal is to infer that signal F star from this relatively small number of photons in Y here. So the question really is, how well can we hope to be able to accomplish that task, and what kinds of features of the problem impact our ability to solve that problem? So I'm going to try to give a little bit of insight into that question by considering a pretty generic kind of solution to this problem. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to infer F star by solving this optimization problem. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at a candidate class of estimators, script F here, and we're going to search or consider all candidate estimators in that class and try to find one which is a good fit to the data through the negative Poisson log likelihood, And which also is a good fit to any kind of prior knowledge you have. So I'm going to represent this for now as a penalty function, but you could also think about it as a regularizer or a negative log prior probability function. So what we'd like to be able to do is say something about how well an estimator of this form would work. And this is an estimator that you see all over the place. It corresponds to a math estimator in a Bayesian framework. It corresponds to several different kinds of frequentist estimators. And we'd like to be able to understand then how well we can hope to perform as a function of what this operator A is, as a function of what our choice of regularizer or penalty function is, and as a function of how much light or how many photons we have available to us. And sort of as a secondary but very important problem is how well can we solve this optimization problem? How well can we actually find this minimizing estimator? So in general, this is a pretty hard problem. I would say that there are four kind of main subsets of this problem of interest. One where that operator A is linear, and the objective function that we're trying to minimize is convex. And in many ways, this is the easiest problem. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time just talking about that in some detail. But as you saw from Stefano's and Anton's talks in the last couple of days, in many situations relating to astrophysics and particle physics, we have nonlinear operators and non-convex objective functions. And there, some of the challenges that we're facing become even more challenging. So I'm going to talk about some of these other problems with nonlinear operators and non-convex objectives a little bit later in the talk. But first, I want to just focus on the simplest case and try to gain a little bit of insight into some of the trade-offs involved here and then try to do some more sophisticated stuff towards the end. So for now, what we're going to do is we're going to assume that this operator here is a nice linear operator, possibly underdetermined, but nonetheless linear, and that our penalty or regularization function is nice and convex and perhaps measures something corresponding to sparsity. I'm going to think a little bit about what happens in this regime. So to understand something about how well we can infer a signal from these Poisson or photon-limited measurements, we can use something that statisticians call an oracle inequality. So I'm going to start with a very kind of general oracle inequality that's not related to inverse problems, and then gradually work my way up to inverse problems. So first of all, let's just assume a simple case where observations are Poisson with intensity F star, and F star is, you think of it as like an image, and the total intensity of the image is going to be denoted I. So I is a scalar. You could think of it as relating to the total power in your laser in the diffraction setting, or you could think about it as corresponding to your total stare time for a satellite in an astronomy setting, or just in general, the average total number of photons that you might hope to observe. Okay, and as I said before, what we're going to do is we're going to try to find an estimate of F star by searching over a class of candidate estimators and finding something that's a good fit to the negative log likelihood and which has a good fit to prior knowledge. Now, for this oracle inequality, we're going to think about the fit to prior knowledge in a very specific and, I think, very helpful way. In particular, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say for every element in this class of candidate estimators, I'm going to develop a code that I can use to describe that estimate to somebody else. And I'm going to let L here correspond to the number of bits in that code. So if I've got some prior knowledge of what I think F star looks like, then I should be able to communicate my estimate F to you with a relatively small number of bits if F corresponds to the prior information, right? If you and I have the same prior information, and I want to describe some function F to you that is very close to that prior information, then all I have to do is tell you how things are different from that prior information. I should be able to do that very easily. Whereas if I have an estimate which is very far away from some prior information or very different from the prior information, then it should be more difficult for me to communicate that to somebody else. Okay, so we're going to think of our penalty or regularizer is corresponding to a code length associated with the estimate. And it turns out that if we were to perform this kind of optimization in order to estimate F-star, then we can say something pretty powerful and helpful about the performance of that estimate. So in particular, what we can show is that the expected squared Hellinger distance between our estimate and the truth. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about why I think this Hellinger distance is really important and perhaps helpful for applications in astrophysics and particle physics in a few slides. But for now, just think of it as a measure of the distance between our estimate and ground truth. Okay, what we can do with this oracle inequality is we can say that the distance between our estimate based on data and the true underlying intensity is bounded by the best estimator in our class of candidate estimators, where we measure best in terms of how well we can approximate the true non-noisy signal and the code length of that approximation. Okay, so what we're saying is that we can perform using noisy data almost as well as somebody else could perform if they knew the ground truth and they tried to pick the best kind of candidate estimator according to this criterion based on the ground truth. So similar oracle inequalities exist throughout the statistics literature, many of them without this code length perspective, and I've listed quite a few of them here at the bottom. But I like the code length perspective quite a bit because it allows us to think about the regularization function in terms of a generalized notion of sparsity. So in the statistics and signal processing and computer science and applied math communities over the last several years, there's been a really strongly growing interest in the use of sparsity in solving underdetermined, high-dimensional, noisy statistical inference problems. So let me talk a little bit about how code length and sparsity are connected. And we can start with let me take a quick aside here. So this is a very nice kind of theorem, and it gives us a little bit of insight into what's happening. But the question now is, how do we actually use it? All right, if you're trying to design an estimation scheme, and you get control over two key elements here. First is the class of models or the class of estimators you're going to consider. And second is the choice of code that you could use. Okay, so this introduces several very interesting trade-offs, I think. One thing that you could do is you could choose that model class F to be very small. And so that's kind of nice in the context of this oracle inequality here, because if there's only a small number of elements in this class of candidate estimators, then we can design a code that has very, very short code length, right? And that's going to keep this term in our error bound very small. And overall, we want this total error bound to be as small as possible. So if we choose that model class to be small, then we can keep our code length small, but the problem is that we can start to introduce a lot of approximation error, right? It could be that what we're really searching for, the physical phenomenon that we're really interested in, is nothing like anything in this kind of small constrained model class. So in general, you want to keep this model class as big and as rich as possible. But once you do that, then you have to figure out how to choose this code length function. And that becomes a kind of challenging thing to do. You'd like to make it so that it is a convex function. You make that code length function a convex function, then it becomes relatively easy to solve that optimization problem that I have in my theorem. And that's important, right? My theorem only tells me something about the globally optimal solution to my optimization problem, and it doesn't tell me anything about local minima. So I want to be sure that I can find the global minimum every time. So you'd like to choose some kind of code that ensures that you've got a nice convex objective. You'd also like to choose this code so that estimators which conform to your prior information have short code length, right? Because then if you have a true signal F star which conforms to your prior information and which is close to something in this class of candidate estimators that you're considering, then you are basically ensuring that your approximation error is small and this estimation error or code length is small. So we kind of have a nice little general framework here that allows us to design algorithms and methods which have nice provable performance guarantees associated with them. Okay, so the question is really, I think, how to design these codes. You want them to be nice and convex. You also want them to kind of conform to prior information. And as I mentioned, one of the nice ways to think about this is having code links correspond to generalized notions of sparsity. So, for instance, let's say that you wanted to search among images of the night sky and find the one which is the best fit to your observed data. I could encode images like this by simply telling you where the non-zero pixels are located or where the stars are located and the brightness of each of those non-zero pixels. And the idea is that in situations like this where there's a small number of stars relative to the total number of pixels in the image, I can communicate the locations of those stars very efficiently with a very small code length. So the sparser this image is, the fewer stars that are located in the image, then the shorter my code length is, and the better I'll be able to perform according to this oracle inequality. Okay, of course, we're not always looking for stars. In many cases, our signals or our images are much more complex. But we can also think about sparsity in some other basis or domain. So, for instance, here's an image here, which is certainly not sparse. There's a lot of non-zero pixels in it. But if I were to compute the wavelet transform of that image, then most of the wavelet coefficients are zero or very close to zero. And so, again, I could encode this image very efficiently with a very short code length by just telling you where the non-zero coefficients are and the magnitudes of those coefficients. Okay, we could also think about codes and sparsity in terms of things like textures or patches or redundancies within the signal. So this is not an image that shows up a lot in the physics applications that we've seen this week, but I think it captures some really nice intuition where you've got an image here which certainly is not sparse in a wavelet transform basis. It's certainly not sparse in a pixel basis. It's hard to imagine many bases where it's sparse. But what you could do is you could imagine taking little patches from this image, little 8x8 groups of pixels. And if you were to look at those patches, and here's a subset of the patches from that image, you'd see that a lot of the patches look very, very similar, right? There's a lot of structure that's repeating itself over and over throughout this image. And so one thing that I could do to encode this image or to communicate it with a very short code length and ensure strong performance according to my oracle inequality is to come up with some kind of representative set of patches and tell you for each patch in my image how similar it is to those representatives. Right? So you see here, excuse me, a lot of patches just look like these binary edges, right? You've got a bright part, a dark part, and a straight line in between them. Other patches look like horizontal stripes. Other patches look like diagonal stripes. And so I could approximate most of the regions in this image as a combination of just a small number of representative patches and have a very efficient code for communicating this image. Okay, just one final example, which I think is closely related to something that Anton was talking about yesterday, which has to do with manifold learning. So one way to think about coding and sparsity is to say, here's a collection of different images, and if I wanted to tell you exactly what that image looked like by just communicating the pixels, then it would take a lot of bits for me to communicate that, a very long code length. But if I know ahead of time that my image is in this class here, and each image in this class corresponds to just a rotation of this teapot, then there's a relatively small number of real intrinsic degrees of freedom, right? To think about all of these images here as being points along a very low-dimensional manifold, even though each of the images is itself a very high-dimensional vector. So this corresponds to the example that Anton was showing us yesterday, where we had a molecule that was rotating on a, I think he said, popsicle. And so you can think about those manifold learning techniques as basically being a way to encode images or molecule conformations using a relatively small number of degrees of freedom or a short bit length code. Okay, so these codes are a very kind of general purpose tool. They correspond to things like sparsity or manifolds or other tools that we use quite a bit in order to perform statistical inference. Okay, and so basically what this oracle inequality gives us is that for a variety of different kinds of generalized sparsity models or different kinds of code lengths, performance guarantees on how well we can actually perform estimation. Okay, so in one way to kind of think about this is that this framework gives us guarantees on estimation performance for all signals, true signals F star, which admit, let's say, a sparse approximation. Okay, so let me just say one kind of quick word about why I think this Hellinger distance is particularly interesting and perhaps helpful to particle physicists and astrophysicists in particular. This Hellinger distance between two probability distributions can be written as the difference between the square root of one distribution and the square root of another distribution. You take that difference squared and you integrate over the domain of your probability distribution. And what you can show is that this Hellinger distance can be used to bound the L1 distance between two probability distributions both below and above. Right? So if we can make sure that the Hellinger distance is small, then we're simultaneously giving ourselves a bound on the L1 error between two probability distributions. And the L1 error, I think, is very significant in the context of photon science because of something called Chef's identity. So Chef's identity says this. It says, let's consider two probability distributions. You could think about this as sort of like the distribution of photon emissions in a scene. That's the distribution I'm talking about here. So we're going to consider two distributions. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at the probability measure of a Borel measurable set D according to distribution 1 versus the probability measure of the same set according to distribution 2. And if we look at the supremum of that distance or difference over all possible Borel measurable sets, it's equal to half of the L1 error or the L1 distance. So this oracle inequality gives us control over this squared Hellinger distance, which in turn gives us control over the L1 error, which in turn tells us something about the worst-case error that we could make on any Borel measurable subset of our domain. And so that's a very powerful, I think, equality or inequality. It tells us that overall, kind of globally, our performance isn't too bad, but also if we were to kind of focus in on any little subregion, we couldn't be doing too bad on any subregion. And so I think that's a very helpful kind of guarantee to have associated with some of the methods that you're trying to develop. Okay, so that all pertains to kind of direct observation models. We didn't have this inverse problem setting or this operator that was transforming our signal before we performed our estimation. So now let's talk a little bit about inverse problems. So remember, I said we're considering a linear inverse problem, and A here corresponds to our forward model. So we map our true signal F star to A F star. And you can think about AJI as corresponding to the probability of a photon being emitted from location I in the signal that you're interested in and traveling to location J on your detector. Okay, so it's a linear inverse problem, but there are certain kind of physical constraints associated with this operator A that are important to kind of keep in mind. First of all, of course, is that all of the elements of this operator are nice and non-negative. And furthermore, we've got something called flux preservation, which basically says that if we add up all the photons we collect, it can't be any more than the number of photons that we started with. So very simple, very basic stuff, but I think worth keeping in mind in some of our subsequent discussion here. Okay, so we can now think about this oracle inequality that we've been discussing in the context of these inverse problems. So let's just say that our operator A here satisfies this very special criteria. So it says, if I were to choose any F1 and F2, which are in the class of candidate estimators or corresponded to the truth, and I were to look at the squared L2 distance between them and compare that to the squared L2 distance between them after applying this operator A, I'm going to hope that those two distances are similar, right? Or in other words, I'm going to assume that the difference between those, the ratio between this distance using the operator A and the distance without using the operator A is bounded below by a constant C and bounded above by a constant capital C. Okay, I'm going to assume that this holds for everything in my candidate class of estimators. So, for instance, in the context of compressed sensing, you would be considering sparse estimators. So, strip depth would correspond to signals that are sparse. And you would have the assumption, which many people call the restricted isometry property, which says that for all sparse signals, applying your linear operator A does not really change the energy in your difference signal. Okay, so we're going to kind of arm ourselves with this assumption. And then we're going to say, let's say that we make Poisson observations of this model, or this forward model A times F star. And we're going to do the same exact kind of penalized likelihood estimation using code links that we've been talking about here. Okay, so then it turns out that what we can do is we can bound the expected mean squared error associated with this approach using this kind of oracle inequality. And it's the same story as before, only now these constants that showed up in our assumption are showing up in our oracle inequality. And I'm presenting this in the context of L2 norms because it's easier to connect with some of the existing literature, but similar kinds of results would also hold for L1 norms. Okay, so what we'd like to be able to do is to see if there are situations where this A matrix is such that little c and big C are both close to 1. And if they're both close to 1, then we've got a really nice oracle inequality, but if big C is big and little c is really small, then things start to fall apart really quickly. Okay, so there's a couple of big questions now associated with this inverse problem setup and our ability to control our errors. One question says, all right, let's just say I can choose this matrix A to be anything I want. I'm building a camera, for instance, and I want to design A in order to ensure that my performance is going to be good. Then what's the right A to choose? And this is the question that's really been posed in the context of compressed sensing. So you could imagine saying, I've only got a fixed number of photo detectors in my camera, and I want to take advantage of them to the maximal extent possible and ensure that I'm going to get the highest resolution possible with that kind of fixed set of a small number of photo detectors. So that's the first question that we're going to look at a little bit here. The other question, though, which I think is perhaps a little bit more relevant, is that if you have some limited control over this sensing matrix A, then how can you actually kind of optimize some of the trade-offs that are introduced by these oracle inequalities and some of the theoretical performance bounds that we've seen? Okay, so first of all, let's look at this compressed sensing setting. The kind of canonical or maybe most famous example of a compressed sensing matrix says that the forward model A would correspond to a Bernoulli ensemble matrix. Okay, so here M is the number of, say, pixels in the scene F star that we want to reconstruct, and N is the number of photo detectors that we have, or the number of measurements that we're going to collect. And in general, we're interested in the case where N is smaller than M. We have a nice underdetermined system. And for the most part, they choose the elements of this matrix to be plus or minus 1 properly normalized, and plus or minus 1 with equal probability. So it turns out that if you do this, you can show that you satisfy something called the restricted isometry property, so that big C and little c in that assumption we had in the previous slide are approximately equal to 1, which is what we want. So what we'd really like to do is to consider a situation where we observe this A tilde times F star. But I mentioned a couple of slides ago that, of course, we've got physical constraints that we have to deal with in the context of photon science, physical constraints that aren't dealt with in the majority of the compressed sensing literature. In particular, we have to deal with non-negativity and flux preservation. So if we take that matrix, or I'm sorry, if we look at this matrix here, certainly it's not non-negative, and it turns out it also does not preserve flux. So one thing that we could do is we could take it and we could shift all the elements so everything is nice and non-negative, and we could rescale everything so that we have something that's flux preserving. And so this would be our kind of new sensing matrix, which conforms with, you know, the physical constraints that we're facing. And the question now is, you know, how well can we expect to be able to perform using this kind of compressed sensing matrix? So we could think about it this way. We started off with this sort of ideal or canonical or famous compressed sensing matrix, A tilde, which was not non-negative, not flux preserving. And then we made some adjustments to it to ensure that our physical constraints were adhered to. And so our new measurements, the things that we can actually measure, even before, you know, having to worry about photon limitations, correspond to these ideal measurements, which have been rescaled, plus a background constant intensity, which corresponds to the total intensity of the scene we're trying to reconstruct. So right away, a sharp statistician might notice a problem here. We're going to be making Poisson observations of this quantity here. And the variance of a Poisson random variable is equal to its intensity or its mean, right? And so what's going to happen is that we're going to have this kind of true signal or ideal signal that we're interested in, plus a huge background which is going to dominate the variance of our noise. Right? And it turns out that if you were to take this kind of framework and plug it into these oracle inequalities that we've been talking about, that exactly that kind of effect just pops out there naturally. So, for instance, we could say a star is sparse in some basis phi. You think about it as like a wavelet basis, for instance, and theta, star here, corresponds to the coefficient. I'm actually going to do something a little bit gentler than sparsity. I'm just going to say that if I were to approximate it with k non-zero coefficients, that approximation error behaves like k to the minus alpha. This is what's called compressibility. I can have a nice sparse approximation to my signal. So it turns out that what our oracle inequality says is that if you were to use this kind of canonical compressing framework blindly in the context of Poisson noise and take into account physical constraints, then our squared error scales like this quantity here. So remember, m is the number of pixels we want to reconstruct, n is the number of photodetectors we have, and the number of observations we collect. Alpha is something about compressibility. So this part right here is exactly what we might expect based on most of compressed sensing. But what happens is that when you take into account physical constraints associated with photon science and Poisson noise, you see that the error actually is going to increase as a function of the number of measurements that you have, right? So if you keep the total amount of light available fixed and you start increasing the number of measurements that you collect, then at some point you're just going to be spreading your photons out over so many different types of measurements that you're not going to be able to recover from the noise. And I'm, again, presenting all of this in the context of L2 errors, but similar things happen in the context of L1 errors. And we did a little experiment here where we studied different intensity levels and different sparsity levels, and these theoretical predictions offered by the oracle inequalities just fell right out of our simulation. So, for instance, you could look at this curve right here. So the horizontal axis here corresponds to n, the number of measurements, and the vertical axis corresponds to the error of our reconstruction. So what we see is that, obviously, if you only have one photodetector, you're going to have a pretty poor error. And as you increase the number of photodetectors, then for a while your error is going to go down. But at some point you reach a sweet spot where if you continue to increase the number of detectors, you continue to kind of spread out your signal and increase the noise associated with each measurement to the point where your error starts to actually get worse and worse as you increase the number of measurements. Okay, so these oracle inequalities, I think, are very valuable for trying to understand some of the trade-offs that we face. That said, most of the time we're not trying to build a compressed sensing system. And what we're really interested in is trying to harness this theory to understand how to build better systems or how to improve our ability to perform reconstruction lifts in existing systems. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk now about how in kind of more constrained systems, this theoretical framework can help us to understand the trade-off between the diversity of our measurements and how we handle the scarcity of the photons that we collect. Here's an example from tomography. In tomography, you could imagine collecting your tomographic projections multiple different ways. One is just kind of a conventional way where you collect projections from every possible angle at some amount of discretization. And so here, this represents kind of the different angles at which we're collecting our tomographic projections, and this is the corresponding reconstruction. Alternatively, you might consider only collecting projections from a small number of different angles, which is called sparse angle tomography. And the idea here is that you limit the dose associated or given to your patient and hopefully don't kill them. And you can see that provides some, artifacts associated with the reconstruction. On the other hand, there's a trade-off because, of course, you've kept your patient healthier. And you could also consider limited angle tomography. And so this oracle inequality framework that I've been talking about here helps us assess the trade-offs associated with different kinds of schemes for choosing the angles associated with tomographic projections. You could also use it to consider things like separating a fluorescent background from a Raman spectrum and Raman spectroscopy. But I'm running a little bit short on time, and so I'm just going to fly by that. And also just mention very quickly that you could use a similar kind of theoretical framework to think about how to design aperture codes in a coded aperture imaging system. So this is a very powerful framework, I think. But as I said, it's really just one corner and perhaps even a disproportionately small corner of the problem space that we're interested in. So we saw some pretty challenging problems presented by Anton and Stefano. And one of the things that we saw is that they are typically or frequently faced with a non-convex optimization problem, which is very difficult to solve accurately. So one strategy that is somewhat emerging in the statistics community is the following. Try to take this very complicated, nonlinear, non-convex problem and relax it so that you have a new problem which is linear and convex, and you can apply all the machinery that we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes, and then try to show that this relaxed problem gives a solution that's very close to the best possible solution you could have gotten in your original framework. Okay, so this is a very hard thing to do, of course, and it's really not clear how to do it in a general setup yet. But I think it's really worth thinking about, because if you can do this, then you're guaranteed that every time you've found the optimal solution, and you don't have to worry about whether you're in a local minimum, what kind of accuracy is associated with that local minimum, or other challenges like that. Okay, so I'm now going to kind of go into an area where I do not have any personal experience, but I thought that this material would be very helpful to some people based on the discussions presented by by Anton and Stefano. So the following slides were given to me by Thomas Stromer at UC Davis, who was looking at this phase retrieval problem that Stefano and Anton spent so much time talking about. And it shows up, as they mentioned, in a wide variety of applications. The basic idea is that you want to recover F, but you don't observe F directly. Rather, you observe its Fourier transform magnitude squared. So it's ill-posed. In many cases, it's underdetermined. And solving this problem is an enormous challenge. And what you'd really like to be able to do is to kind of set it up so that you can guarantee that your algorithm is finding the globally optimal solution, even in the context of noise. Okay, so I'm going to kind of rewrite the problem formulation a little bit more generally and say that my operator now, and I'm going to ignore noise for just a couple of minutes here, my operator corresponds to taking my signal F, projecting it onto a vector A, and then looking at the magnitude squared of that projection or of that inner product. Okay, so you could think about the AKs as corresponding to Fourier basis functions, but they could also correspond to other more general vectors. So what you'd like to be able to do is find some F or some signal which matches these magnitude measurements but has the correct phase information. Okay, so I'm going to kind of fly through this because Anton and Stefano did such a great job talking about the standard approach associated with alternating projections. The key point that I really want to make here is that there is no proof of convergence to the optimal solution. You're always having to worry about whether you're ending up in some local minimum. And so the approach that Thomas Stromer and his collaborators, including Emmanuel Candes, developed is based on a 2007 paper which said the following. Instead of working just with F, which is the thing we're really interested in, let's instead consider this matrix capital F, which corresponds to F times F transpose. Okay, so capital F now is a rank one matrix. And remember that our measurements are of this form, right? We take little f, compute its inner product with a vector ak, and then compute the magnitude squared of that inner product. And we can write that as a trace corresponding to these inner products squared, which we can in turn write as a trace function of this rank one matrix capital F. So the basic strategy that they propose is to solve for F and capital F instead of little f, and then once you've got capital F, you can figure out what little f is pretty readily. Okay, so taking what was initially a very nonlinear, non-convex problem, and then figuring out a way to relax it into a convex problem which we can solve and have strong theoretical guarantees associated with it. Okay, so instead of solving, so the basic strategy is going to be to find a matrix F which corresponds to the data and has rank one, and then after we've got that, we can just do a very simple factorization. Okay, now, this is still hard. Trying to minimize the rank of a matrix is an NP-hard problem in general, and this is where the convex relaxation that I mentioned comes into play. So you could think about the trace function as corresponding to a convex surrogate of this rank function that we're really ultimately interested in. Yet if we try to look at this problem here, it's suddenly solvable. Whereas the problem at the top was NP hard, the problem at the bottom corresponds to a semi-definite program, and there's a wealth of literature on how to solve that and find a globally optimal solution. So I am out of time, so I'm just going to talk about how basically this produces a new regime for performing phase estimation or phase retrieval in a framework that corresponds to convex optimization. So in particular, Candes, Stromer, and Wororinsky showed that if you were to perform these projections, and if they did not necessarily correspond to the Fourier projections that we're typically used to seeing, but instead corresponded to random projections, then with a relatively small number of projections, we can figure out the true phase information exactly using these kinds of semi-definite programming ideas. And, of course, you can incorporate Poisson noise. This is bounded noise. You can also incorporate the Poisson noise that we've been talking about throughout our discussion. So this is certainly not complete, and Thomas admits this pretty readily and says, you know, for instance, in many cases we're kind of constrained to make Fourier projections of the signal that we want to retrieve the phase of. Whereas the theory here corresponds to somewhat different kinds of projections. On the other hand, I think it does provide some helpful theoretical insights and is, you know, really just getting started. And so the hope is that perhaps using some of these techniques, we can develop new systems that will allow us to perform these phase retrieval operations much more accurately than we were able to do before. So to wrap up, I just want to kind of say that in the context of these linear inverse problems, the oracle inequalities give us some, I think, very valuable insight. They help us relate notions of photon limitations and sparsity and convex optimization in one very nice, clean, elegant framework. And that's helpful because it allows us to think very carefully about how we design our measurement systems and what kind of performance we can hope to get out of our reconstruction algorithms. The nonlinear, non-convex problems are significantly more challenging and difficult to solve. It's very difficult to find these global optima. But it's possible that some of the convex relaxation techniques that are being developed as we speak may help alleviate this challenge in future research. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
First of all, really great talk. I loved it. I have a comment and a comment in one-dimensional time series, L1 optimization, recover phase information, that's the arrow of time and so on. And I wonder if you have found that in this kind of work. But I don't know if you've had a chance to compare L1 and L2 in that sense.
So,
your leg up on the phase retrieval.
So as I mentioned, I don't have any personal experience with phase retrieval, so I'm really giving a shout-out here to other people's work because I thought it might be helpful and interesting to this community. So I can't really speak to the ability of L1 to do strong phase retrieval. That said, Stefan Mala came out with a new paper on archive systems, I think yesterday or the day before, where they were comparing several different conventional methods for phase retrieval with this kind of phase-less approach and a variant of it, and showed that these convex relaxations consistently do better with the random projections. And they showed that with the Fourier projections, nothing does particularly well.
And could you just say, with projections, what does that mean in practice and measurement? Well, you said it, and I missed it.
You know, I have a slide, and somehow I removed it. But so this is kind of the normal picture associated with X-ray crystallography, for instance. So what they suggested instead was inserting a little mask here. So you've got a coated aperture mask, basically. And you would use multiple different masks to get these multiple different projections. And so that involves, some non-trivial hardware. But that said, it doesn't, they do have kind of some specific ideas in mind of how you might accomplish this.
That's something that you can comment on the coded aperture work, which is something that we have tried.
Well, there is a limitation. There is a limitation in the... if you want to get atomic resolution, you would need an atomic resolution mask.
Yeah, that's right. So coated apertures are relatively easy in imaging systems because you can just put chroma on quartz and get the resolution you want, but making a mask that high resolution for the stuff you're doing, I think, can be quite a bit harder. Another thing that I would say is that, when there's theory here, they prove things about how well these methods perform in the context of noise, assuming the noise is bounded. Now, they don't prove anything about how you would actually make these things work in the context of Poisson noise. I mean, they present an objective problem, function, which you can solve. But my suspicion is that you're going to run into some of the same challenges that we run into in the linear case, which is that you're going to have this kind of background, which is going to dominate or control your noise variance. And when you have the mask in there, you're just going to have a very kind of challenging inverse problem that's going to be hard to handle in the context of noise. But that's totally speculative. It's really not here at this point.
So I enjoyed your talk very much. And it was a beautiful survey, as surveys have to be at 10,000 feet. Now, I'd like to describe the problem of photon science as much as I can see it, phase retrieval is, of course, the last step, in the sense that, first of all, you have a bunch of snapshots from unknown orientations of an unknown object, and you have to, whether that's in real space or Fourier space, first you have to reconstruct a three-dimensional volume.
Mm-hmm.
If the three-dimensional volume is a diffraction volume, then you need to do phase retrieval. But that need not be the case, and there are other instances where that's not the case. The most difficult problem, actually, is reconstructing this three-dimensional volume because you have extremely low signal. In that case, one has to say that, in fact, the sample is overdetermined, not underdetermined, and the mapping function is intrinsically nonlinear, and linearizing it essentially throws out the baby with the bathwater. Now, many of the concepts you introduce can actually be formulated in a nonlinear sense, necessarily in a differential geometric sense, and the Oracle inequality, which you mentioned, can be formulated as a Lipschitz equivalence between manifolds and described in terms of a metric.
Mm-hmm.
So there are nonlinear equivalents already existing for these kinds of measures, and something you might like to take a look at.
All right. Thank you very much. Yeah. I do agree that several aspects of the inequalities apply. What's not really clear for nonlinear systems is, you know, when something like this holds. Right, and so trying to assess that even for linear systems can be pretty challenging. And for nonlinear systems, I would imagine it's even more.
That is exactly a Lipschitz equivalent expression in different manifolds. And I'd be happy to describe that to you in private.
Okay.
And if you'll comment. And in fact, there are well-known techniques for determining that from metrics of manifolds. So you can get these Oracle inequalities directly from a differential geometric description in a nonlinear case.
Okay. Yeah, I would like to talk more about that. Thank you. Okay. Yeah.
I was wondering, you mentioned this code base, I forgot the exact word, but let's say that you have redundant dictionaries that are not non-orthogonal bases. How many dictionaries can you throw at the problem before you run into trouble?
So, okay, let me just try to recap the problem. The idea is that you want to represent your signal in terms of a dictionary, and maybe this is the closest picture I've got for that. You could say each patch is a linear combination of patches from a big dictionary of candidate patches, right? And the question is, how big can you make that dictionary? So what I would say is that the bigger you make that dictionary, you make that dictionary particularly big, and you're going to have problems with controlling your code length. You're also going to have problems with convexity. And so there are some strategies out there. Not really sure what the fundamental limit on the number of dictionary elements is. In general, though, you want to try to keep it small, because if you make it too big, then the computation also becomes more challenging. So I haven't seen a whole lot of analysis where people are trying to make the dictionary as big as possible. In general, they're trying to see how small they can make it and still have everything work.
Okay, we should actually stop now because it's coffee time. Thank you, Becca, and thanks to all the speakers.
And also, I mentioned that there's a card small next building. Maybe it's more realistic over there.
Yeah, what you said is correct. It is small, you can get a number of it's very good. I can send you a link if you want. It's very good.
Are they?
Yeah. is like a continuous thing. And it's not like optional, and just need to objective. It still has
and everything around it.
Except like the XML.
Well, so far where you can outsource value of like a very large
understand that. Yeah.
when he says that the scientific paper would be easy. Ah, there you go.
Meetings, and then it shows up in a little story. If it's
happens, it'll be at 12:30. Yeah, I'll let you know.
Inviting me to report on this conference that was held about 6 months ago in Madrid. I would highly recommend Madrid in the pre-Christmas time. It was very beautiful, and apparently Spain needs your money. The title of the conference was very interesting, the controversy about hypothesis testing. Okay, my outline of the talk is obviously I was asked to report what it was about, but I'm also going to talk a little bit what I thought the conference was going to be about, and that is not exactly the same thing, those two. Moreover, also what was meant, what it was meant to be about by the people who called for the conference. The first talk was given by Jose Bernardo, a very well known for people here. He has been to several of our conferences, of course, very famous for reference priors. The title of his talk was Hypothesis Testing from a Decision Theory Viewpoint, a General Objective Bayesian Approach. One problem Bayesians have with hypothesis testing in general is that you, if you wish to test the sharp null hypothesis, zeta equals zeta zero, then you will need to use a prior that gives a positive probability to that point, zeta equals zeta zero, probability of alpha greater than zero. That makes your prior immediately subjective because that choice of alpha is whatever you need to, you think it should be at this point. Moreover, this is not the kind of priors that one generally uses for estimation problems. There you usually use a smooth prior over the space of the parameter. And finally, those methods end up generally not being invariant under parameter transformations. His idea then was to use decision theory for coming up with your prior, but instead of the usual 0-1 loss function that is leads to these other problems, use a smooth one. Specifically, he uses the intrinsic discrepancy loss function, which is a symmetric version of the well-known Kalbeck-Leibler divergence given here, the integral P1 log P1 over P2. With this prior, then, you may end up with a method that is invariant under parameter transformations, and you can use it both for estimation and hypothesis testing. As an example, he talked about this very well-known, famous, or infamous example in ESP. Jan, Dunning, and Nelson in 87 did these experiments with a random number generator where that is supposed to come out 50-50. Zeros and ones, but they had people trying to think very hard to make it ones and rather than zeros. And in 104 billion trials, they got 52 million successes for a probability of 0.5017 instead of 0.5. Now, if you do the hypothesis test for 0.5 versus not 0.5, sorry, that should be a 0.5 there. Any frequency test, given the gigantic sample sizes, will give you a p-value about 0.0003, and therefore you would reject that null hypothesis. And, of course, for them, that meant, oh, we have found ESP. On the other hand, a Bayesian approach to this problem is a little bit different. Jeffrey, for example, used this in 1990. He used the prior that is a bit of a mixture of a point at 0.5 with the probability P0 and otherwise smeared out over the 0-1. And he showed that with this prior, the probability, the posterior probability of the null hypothesis being true is always greater than that P0 that he puts in. So you could make it as big as you want to. And that, of course, is one of the famous examples for Lindley's paradox. Bernardo applies his new method to this as well, and it turns out that he actually agrees with the frequentist answer. That is, using his methodology, you also reject the null hypothesis. Obviously, he's not saying that ESP existed, but there were some other problems with the experimental setup, clearly. The next talk was by Art DeVos and Mark Franke from the University of Amsterdam. No more null hypothesis, just decisions. The premise for their work is the main objective for hypothesis testing is decision making. That's why people do hypothesis tests, to say, okay, now we're going to do this or we're going to do something else. Bayesians are very good at decision theory. Unfortunately, it's a hard work to get it set up right. On the other hand, frequentist hypothesis testing is very simple. Reject the null hypothesis if your p-value is less than some alpha. Unfortunately, that sweeps the hard work under the rug because it's easy. It works easy because it doesn't take into account the wrong decisions, the cost of the wrong decisions. You use, but people in other fields use alpha to be 5%, and they don't ever very much for that. You, of course, use 5 sigma, but as long as this is always a strict standard, the same issue, in fact, exists. The idea, then, is to use Bayesian decision theory to come up with an appropriate alpha in any one problem. If S is some test statistic and BF of S is its base factor, the formula shown up here, then if you look at then they define a kappa, the prior probability times its loss divided by the prior of the null times its loss function divided by the prior of the alternative, or times its loss function. And then you should choose alpha as the probability that your base factor is greater than that kappa given the null hypothesis. So in some sense, this is similar to Bernardo in that it makes use of the decision theory, but it's diametrically opposed to Bernardo in that you automatically end up with a subjective choice for alpha because of your choices of the L0 and the L01s up there. Whereas Bernardo's work, of course, always tries to get away from subjective methods. Next talk was by Zeynep Baskurt and Michael Evans from the University of Toronto, hypothesis assessment via base factors and relative belief ratios. Again, the base factor, the formula shown here, if you look just at the denominator of that, that's the relative belief ratio. In the denominator of that, you have the probability of the null under the prior, and the problem is what is that? That has to be zero. The usual solution is to just pick a number and not let it be zero. Their solution is to essentially have a transformation, embed that into a larger set that depends on some epsilon, and when you make the epsilon smaller and smaller, it shrinks down to your original choice of gamma. That leads to the base factor under the null down here. Valen Johnson from the University of Texas Anderson Cancer Center talked about on the importance of distinguishing between hypotheses, the role of non-local prior densities in Bayesian hypothesis testing and model selection. Johnson defined the non-local prior alternative prior densities as prior densities that take the null value of zero for all parameter values consistent with the null, which is exactly the opposite of what's usually done, where you pick the prior that with a maximum value at the null hypothesis. In many applications, the use of these local alternative prior densities, such as intrinsic priors, fractional base factors, makes it impossible to obtain strong evidence in favor of a true null. They have a hard time rejecting the null hypothesis. The use of these non-local prior densities in Bayesian hypothesis testing results in much faster accumulation of evidence in favor of the true null and true alternative hypotheses. He showed this graph here where we have the sample size on the x-axis, and the farther down the curve, the higher your expected weight of evidence, and the two types of priors that he came up with is the MOM method of moments priors and the intrinsic method of moments priors, and you can see certainly the last one accumulates evidence much faster. Publications for that in the Journal of American Statistical Association coming up. This one you've already seen. Andrew Jaffe gave the talk on behalf of his collaboration, but Roberto already showed it as well. In astrophysics, Bayesian statistics has become much more common, and the rise in the number of papers that use Bayesian statistics much faster than the increase in papers in general. This is titled with another part of Roberto's talk, this question of whether the universe is flat. These are the various experiments that have been done, ruling out various parts of parameter space. Here again, the same parts of a number of experiments, with the conclusion in the end that the universe is probably flat. Or at least that's not been ruled out at this point. Next came a talk by Deborah Mayer from the Mayo by Virginia Tech, collaborator of Sir David Cox that has been at a couple of our conferences as well, with the title, Are Frequentist Significance Tests Inconsistent Breaking Through Birnbaum's Breakthrough? In statistics, there are a couple of principles that people want to and try to adhere to. Here is one of them. It's called the strong likelihood principle. And it basically says if you do two experiments and they result in proportional likelihoods, then you should get the same answer out of them. They should yield the same inference. And there's a conditionality principle which says only the experiments that was actually principles, the second and the third, are fairly non-controversial. Most statisticians would adhere to these. On the other hand, the strong likelihood principle has been one of discussions for a long time. It's sort of the dividing line in some ways between frequentists and Bayesians. As a Bayesian, you generally like and adhere to the strong likelihood principle, but frequentist methods generally violate those. In 1962, Birnbaum without any intent to speak with exaggeration or rhetorically, and you know, if somebody starts like that, that's exactly what they want. It seems to me that this is really a historic occasion, but not to take the strong likelihood principle seriously no longer seems possible. I can't know what everyone will do, but I suspect that once the likelihood principle is widely recognized, people will not long stop at the halfway house, but will go forward and accept it. For example, in Casella and Berger, page 294, one of the main statistics textbooks used, in fact, you can find it in pretty much every statistics checkbook in the last 50 years, and yet Deborah Mayo claims to show that Birnbaum's proof is wrong. She says, I don't want to say she does prove that it's wrong because it's a very complicated argument going well into the philosophy of statistics and beyond me to say it right or wrong.
This conference will now be disconnected. Goodbye.